From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're talking about web-based wireframes with special guest, Travis Gertz. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is brought to you by Kraft. Kraft is a flexible and easy-to-use CMS that cares as much about your content as you do. Want to check it out? Just head over to demo.buildwithcraft.com and you can get your own personalized demo site to fool around with in minutes.
So before I introduce our guest today, I want to give our listeners a bit of a backstory. So I think it was right around the time, Leah, that you joined my company and you gave me this resource for web-based wireframes.
Right.
I bookmarked it. I didn't really think much of anything about it. But when we got our first client together, I decided I wanted to try a different approach to wireframes. So I pulled that bookmark out and spent an afternoon. And as it turned out, it was LiveWires. And the long story short is that they ultimately completely changed our workflow. They changed how, you know, what we deliver to clients, kind of how we think of wireframes in our process.
Right.
And we're a really big part of us realizing we needed to develop our own internal framework that you and I have been going to conferences and speaking about the past 2 years. So I'm super geek excited about today's episode. I actually was talking to Jason about it all morning. I'm like, I cannot wait to talk to Travis and pick his brain about LiveWires.
Right.
So let's go ahead and introduce Travis. He is the creator of LiveWires. He is a designer and co-owner of Ladder Than 10. And for our old EE podcast listeners, Travis was one of our very first guests for one of our first episodes called EE Gypsies, where we talked about developers who are working from the road. So welcome back to the show, Travis.
Thanks, guys. Good to be back.
Awesome. So, Travis, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Yeah. So I'm a total web generalist, design generalist living in Vancouver. I started with code and design, magazine design, actually, like in 2001, and have been sort of combining those things ever since. And so I live in Vancouver with my wife, and we run our little company out of a shared office and, yeah, build crazy stuff for the internet.
Awesome.
So when I mentioned in the intro that we had you on the EE Gypsies episode, if I recall correctly, you had just come off a kind of RV traveling trip through the U.S. and Canada, and you were en route to Vancouver. And at the time, you were mostly doing client services work, but when I was checking out your company site in preparation for our call today, you're doing so much more than production work. Can you describe how your focus has evolved over the past few years?
Yeah, definitely. I think when we last spoke, it was literally the day before we moved to Vancouver.
So nice.
We've been here ever since. And at the time, we were working for a lot of other agencies, just subcontracting. I was doing a lot of design and development work. Rachel was doing a lot of project management and content strategy, things like that. And so we kind of evolved, started building our own direct clients over that time and doing more and more of our own projects. And about a year and a half ago, we kind of got to the point where we were becoming our own thing. And we just took a step back and we're like, okay, now is the time to make the company we really want to make. And that's not just web design. That's not just development and straight up client services. Rachel's naturally a teacher. She has an education degree. So we wanted to kind of figure out a way to combine those things. And so we started working towards a school for project management. So helping other design agencies, freelancers, project managers figure out this crazy evolving world of web design and how to work with wireframing and new design processes, especially since like our old waterfall workflows didn't really work anymore. So we just ran into a lot of clients and other agencies that were having trouble with their projects. And so we just started going down a path of consulting and training and building courses on top of, and we still do client services now. I still love a lot of that and helps keep us sharp and in the game. So yeah, it's kind of half and half right now.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I think that you just basically described Leia's like dream. She's always talking about how we can introduce education and training into the business because, you know, it's one of her passions.
That's absolutely awesome. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that's a natural thing for a lot of web folk, though, in general, because we're curious people. We dove into this thing where it was all brand new and we know that it's ever evolving and trying to make sure that everyone rises to a certain professional level means you kind of have to tell people how to do that and teach people how to do that, you know? So, you know, that was where my focus is.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think the web in general, especially in the early 2000s, mid 2000s, we all kind of had to learn it from each other and figure it out. There were no schools for it. Like it was, or the schools that were there were not very good. I went to one.
right.
So yeah, I think it's just self-educationally bred industry.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And speaking of where you started from, let's take a step back. Your bio mentioned that you went to school to design magazines. That's what you did at the beginning. How did you make the shift to digital, to websites?
I sort of fell into it accidentally. I actually made my first website, I think, the week before I went to design school. And it was for my parents' company in the garage. And I just had to figure out HTML. And that was it. I was just a total side interest thing. And then I just kept with it throughout school and just thought of different ways you could apply both. And then kind of closer to the end of it, I guess about graduated from college in 2005. And at that time, we had sort of gone through, we were bouncing back from a web bubble and print was a little bit in question. And I just thought, well, this seems like a good combination of things. I can get way more web design work right now. So I just kind of went down that path and have been looking at it through sort of an editorial lens ever since.
So why did you start your own company versus working for someone else? Like, I know you said that you would be doing like subcontracting work for agencies and stuff, but you were still running your own business and deciding who you would work with and such.
Yeah, it's, I don't know what it is. I grew up in a very entrepreneurial household. My dad has a sheet metal company, and we had like a family sign making business out of our garage when I was in college. And so I did that to help pay the bills and everything like that during that time, which got me into design a little bit there. And then afterwards, I like through high school, all I wanted to do was run a business like my dad. Totally naive. I actually applied to go to business school before I went to design school, but my grades weren't good enough for that. And then it's just been a bug in me ever since. I worked for several companies after school just because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And none of those jobs actually lasted more than like a year, year and a half. I would just get itchy feet after 8 or 9 months and be like, I just want to do it myself. And so finally in 2008, when we left on our trip, that's really the first time we took it seriously and been doing it ever since. And I love it. It's hard, but I love it.
Yeah, I echo you there. So let's get to today's main topic, wireframes. Before we talk about live wires, can you talk about your approach to wireframing, your IA process just in general before going web-based? Like, did you have hand sketches, Photoshop, some other tools?
Yeah, I know it's sort of a common approach. Everyone says you got to sketch everything out. I've always tried to sketch everything out a lot on paper before, and I still do occasionally, but I find that, I don't know if it's because I've been in HTML and CSS for so long, I find I can sketch easily in the browser. So that's partly where that comes from. But wireframing in general, I try to keep it really loose. I want to figure out, especially now, the interaction is so much more important than the placement of items on the page. I feel like a lot of times wireframes, especially traditionally, they're very prescriptive up front, and then they lock the actual UI design into a corner. And so I like to avoid that as much as possible and just focus on flow and hierarchy on a very loose level really early. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. So if you were doing wireframe in the browser yourself because you're comfortable in the code, and I totally get that. Sometimes I feel like I could just do it faster that way. But it never would have occurred to me to use that as something I showed a client. Did you always show a client web-based wireframes, or did they get, I don't know, saved as a PDF? Or, you know, did you ever have to kind of revert it from being in the web to be something that you could show a client and they could relate to?
Oh, you know what? No, it sort of grew out of frustration, actually, because I would work with other designers and we'd put together like a balsamic wireframe or something like that, something that's, and it had every little detail in it, all the buttons, all the labels, it was placed everywhere. And we found that it was too much detail. And when we would show the clients that, they would get really confused and wonder, hey, is this the design? And
of course,
balsamic is hideous. At the time, it was like, it would just create all kinds of more questions. And so, and it was really hard to update, and especially with responsive stuff at the time, it was just a pain. And so I said, screw it, I can do this in the browser. All I need is just a very generic set of CSS. It doesn't have to be ugly. It just has to be simple, plain. We can hide the text so no one's getting too hung up on it, but we can still design with real content. And I don't know, it kind of evolved purely out of frustration. And for ourselves, we were just like, we just need a quick little bit of CSS to convey our ideas really quickly so we can just move on. And then as far as dealing with or like communicating that with the clients, we actually find it much easier because they can actually click through. They're a lot more engaged in the wireframes, whereas before they would sort of just look at the picture of the wireframe and be like, yeah, that looks good. That's fine. I don't know what I'm looking at. I guess this will work. But now if you can show them a site that they can click through a little bit, they understand the process a little more. Everything being blanked out, they understand that it's not a final product. And so we just try and be very clear that it isn't at the beginning and help with that educational process. But we actually rarely have any troubles with Livewire wireframes these days.
So I think it's something that's worth going into a little more detail about for our listeners. And it's hard to talk about something that you kind of interact with verbally, you know. But I think one of the things that stood out for me about the Livewires is that it was abstracted from the content. For us, there was something, I think it was, we had an episode with Ben Callahan, and he talked about using a web-based, getting something that's web-based in front of the client sooner in the process so that they're interacting sooner, especially in responsive environments. And, you know, when I saw Livewires, I loved that it gave us that focus. Instead of them focusing on, you know, what the content that's going to be in this block here, they're instead looking at that block and seeing that it, you know, resizes, and this is what happens to, you know, this column when it goes down into another view. So can you talk a little bit, Travis, about how you put together that abstraction? Like, it's pretty simple once you look at the code, but it's pretty cool that it's kind of like old school magazine, or I was on the yearbook staff, so yearbook design, where you just drew a block and it had a squiggle and that indicated it was copy. And in Livewires, it's just sort of like lines that suggest copy might be somewhere.
Yeah. A big part of that was inspired also way back in, I think, around 2007 or something. Jason Santamaria had this blog post where he talks about gray box wireframes.
Yes, I remember reading that. Yeah,
and it was fantastic. It just keeps everything very loose and simple and makes you just focus on a very simple piece of content. It could be anything within there. It has lots of flexibility. And for me, I really liked that. Coming from magazine design, that's exact, like you mentioned with the yearbook, that's exactly how you would lay out magazine sections. You understand that there's going to be variation in those pieces, and you kind of want to abstract content out of that part at that stage, I feel like. At the same time, you still want some content to work with, especially for the design process, so you know, okay, how big should we make our blog post excerpts, for example, or, you know, you still need to work with something, but you don't necessarily want to show it off at that point. And so all we did is we added some simple classes at first that hid the text and replaced it with a background image of gray bars. Just hide the text. It's hidden from clients, but we can actually still edit, copy. Rachel, my partner there, she's a content strategist and writer, but she knows HTML, just basic HTML. So she can actually go in the files and start writing copy really early, which is very helpful for us. But it still leaves that separation for us, allows variation. Later on, as we've evolved, we've actually changed that technique into just, it's still available in Livewires, but we've just installed a font called Noé Block, I think. And all it does is it's just a font made of rectangles, basically.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So you don't even have to apply that technique. I just include a Livewire style sheet that changes all the content text to this font, and it's great. And it actually reflows way more accurately even than the old way.
So are you saying that there's actual like content, as if like if you guys are already starting the content strategy process, it's a real paragraph in the HTML, but then this font in the browser looks like blocks, so they aren't distracted by the content yet.
Yeah, exactly.
That's brilliant.
Thanks. Yeah, we came up, like, obviously, we found this font. This font existed, I think it came out about 2 years ago, and I saw it, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's perfect. And it was designed in exactly for that intent, and we just applied it into Livewires. It was great. I forget who designed it, but they were the brilliant ones who came up with that idea. So.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I feel like in retrospect, you're like, well, duh, right? But at the end of the day, though, you know, the more, you know, especially when we had Steph Hay talking about how important content first design is, if you actually do have the content first, but you still want to not distract the client with the words itself so they can start nitpicking copy when it isn't even the point yet, you know, just hiding it by the mere font is kind of brilliant to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice for us because we can just switch the style sheet over if we need to review it. Actually, most of our work, we will write our content in a Markdown editor because usually when we put it in a CMS, it ends up in Markdown. That's just the way we do it. And so we'll put it in. There's a great web app called Draft that we'll use, or we'll just use like AI Writer, IA Writer, and export it out as HTML. And we'll paste that into our Livewires. I think there's ways to automate that now, actually, where you can like hook up Draft to Firebase or something, and then it'll make it JSON file that you can pull into. It's like you can automate that part even, so someone's editing straight in the text file and then bringing it into, and it just automatically updates in Livewires. But we haven't figured that out yet. That's sort of the next thing that I'm working on for it.
Yeah, I feel it's interesting because these are really nice features, and I'm glad we're going over it because I haven't seen the updates that you've released. Because we got this, some of this stuff wasn't even available. Like,
oh, totally.
And I'm like, okay, now I got to go back and update. Awesome. No, but I mean, it's good. I think what I thought was amazing about when I first encountered Livewires was it really was just the wireframes.
Right.
And I've done almost internally done the same thing you guys have done to upgrade your Livewires, which sort of confirms for me I was approaching it the right way, is that I was working with the Livewires, which at the time I wasn't thinking about style guides or typography or how this might move into my actual CMS templates. I was just focusing on the Livewires. And then over time, I was like, wow, I'm investing this time in the Livewires. I'd like that code to serve the next thing. It's not just a Livewire. It's actually becomes the base of my template, which then creates the style guide. And that's exactly what you guys now have in the current version of Livewires. You've got a style guide built in. You've got what you were describing with the font replacing with blocks. That's so cool because I was using the old image replacement technique that you had. There was like an image swap, like a little gray image that was pulled in to replace the text. So you just said, you know, div, class, content, or something like that.
Right.
So no, this sort of confirms that I was thinking of it the right way. But that's how it is. You kind of have to work with something like this, see how it fits for yourself, and evolve it. Which you've done, but I also did, you know, kind of separate the way I like to work. And that's the other thing I loved about Livewires.
Right.
It was so not telling me what to do. It yes. was just like, here's a way you could show, you know, a concept.
Yeah.
And it wasn't all these, you know, you have to use these styles and this is your markup pattern and all this other stuff. I could really just focus on the concept and having it work for me and the way I like to code.
Yeah. Cause I think, you know, as we were talking about, like, you know, evolving our own process and adding new features to Livewires and stuff, I don't think that would be as easy if Livewires was bloated. And that was another reason why we decided to start working with Livewires, was it was really stripped down. Other frameworks basically tell you this is how it's going to be. And it had way more styles and classes and divs that were irrelevant. And some people would say typically they just try to strip down everything once they're ready to production, or they start a separate production, which just wastes so much time. But if you have something that's already stripped down that you can add to, then that's, I feel like, a way more efficient way to deal with templating.
Yeah, you guys hit it right on the head. Like, that's exactly what we designed it for, is 2 points there. First is, yeah, like, the frameworks out there, this is our answer to those frameworks. We just found that they just dictated so many, not only design decisions, but markup decisions and everything else. And we don't want to do that at all. We just want to put in definitely more the philosophy, the approach behind it. And that's really what we're driving at. And so that's the one part of it. And the other, really, we want you to create your own bootstrap or your own foundation using this. And so you have full freedom to do whatever you want. If there's things you don't like, it's easy. We made it easy to ignore it, but it's there if you need it. And then the other point that you guys touched on was evolving it. That's where we've wanted to, that's how we've used it the most over the years. So we think of it as like it's a statue, and we're working with a big piece of granite. And we start off with this really rough, really loose wireframe that we can click through, but we don't want to throw that away. Like traditional wireframes, you draw it in an app and then it goes away. And then you maybe mock it up in Photoshop or something and that goes away. And then you have to redo all of that work in HTML and CSS. And for us, yeah, it was, okay, let's make our wireframe here. And all of a sudden we have a great basis for markup. We have our basic templates. And then where the style guide came in for us was, okay, well, we can start styling many of the general things, like the typography, the buttons, the forms, all the little tiny components that we're going to need. And let's connect the CSS and just see what happens there. And so we built our guide and all these placeholder CSS files that we knew we were going to use. Most of them are empty, but it's just a file structure mostly. And so I usually work on typography first, and then I put in some color variables. And then all of a sudden, as you're sort of filling out these style details in the guide using your CSS, it automatically starts to shape the wireframe. And so your Livewires wireframe all of a sudden has your brand colors in it. It has the right typography applied to it. All the buttons look the same. And so it still looks really rough at that point, but you're getting closer. You're shaping it down, and it's all using the same code. It's building on top of itself. And then sort of that last stage, we'll hop usually after that point, that's when we start maybe jumping back and forth between an image editor or something, just to kind of explore some ideas and get creative a little bit. But then we'll dive right into the CSS again to refine it and make it tight. But for us, it really works well. Yeah, we love it because the progressiveness of it feels great. There's a nice evolution. You can still show clients an evolution of it, which is really nice. That's where a lot of people struggle with, I think, with it, is what do you show the client? When do you show them? What way? And so that's been we've got a few good ways of doing that over the years. But yeah, it's definitely always a challenge for sure.
So I'm curious about that then. How do you decide what to show?
For us, it depends on the project and how savvy the client is. If they are really on board. They understand, like, these days we work with a lot of startups and things like that. So they understand the code really well. They understand the process. And so we'll just show them the progressive nature of it. A lot of times we work with them on it. So every 2 weeks we'll be like, hey, this is what we're working on. And we'll keep it going in a very kind of agile process, which works nice. And so we'll just show them everything as we go. And they understand and they see it come together through the whole process. And that's really great. For other more traditional clients that might be used to seeing mock-ups and things like that, sometimes we'll just take screenshots at different sizes and then we'll just deliver the screenshots. And then they won't get hung up on things like browser issues that might still be happening. And so we'll show them, typically the first thing we show them is the Livewire's wireframe in the process. And then we'll often show them the style guide as it's styled up to give them a sense of what everything's going to look like. It's kind of like showing like style tiles or like a color swatch thing. And then we'll decide, usually we'll just take screenshots of the templates that we've made and then build it out from there.
It's funny you mentioned that because, you know, when we first started using Livewires, we were fortunate that we had pretty much tech savvy clients that like got it essentially right away. Like they weren't confused over what this was. They knew that they could look at it in the browser, et cetera, and so forth. But recently we did try to show some wireframing to a less tech savvy client. And that was at that point where like, maybe we need to do screenshots with annotations on top of just sending them the live wires because we had to like almost over explain in comparison to our past clients. Cause you know, like we can't assume everybody knows what we know or have that, you know, intuitive understanding of what wireframes even are. So it's funny that you mentioned like, yeah, for the traditional clients, we just end up doing the screenshots.
Yeah.
Which is ironic, right?
Yeah, it totally is. But yeah, it works great. I mean, it's quick. The other thing is sometimes we'll even use screenshots for design purposes ourselves. Like, well, I use an app called Page Layers, and I don't know if I'll use it now as much. I use Sketch more often now. Just I like it a little better than Photoshop. But Page Layers, you can take a screenshot and it will go through all the HTML elements and text and put them on separate layers in a Photoshop. So you actually have like a fleshed out Photoshop document based on a screenshot, basically. And it makes manipulating that in Photoshop really easy and fun. And so you can actually take your HTML template, take a screenshot of it in there, and then just start moving things around and editing and hiding things. And just, it's a really nice workflow for experimenting with, we find. But they just need to add Sketch now.
Cool.
So this was an internal thing I imagine you built yourself, but then you put it out to the public. What did you expect by releasing it?
I don't know. For me, it's always been very much our tool. I felt like the thing that we use to build style guides and our sites for our clients. And I just always imagined that it'd be useful for other people. And I thought, well, you know, it's on GitHub anyway. Let's mm-hmm. make it public and sure. maybe other people will get some use out of it. And it hasn't gotten a ton of attention or anything like that. But there's just, we know a few agencies that use it kind of similar to you guys. And almost everybody takes it and makes it their own,
mm-hmm.
which is amazing to me. That's exactly in the spirit of Livewires in my mind. It's like every shop and every designer and every developer, they kind of have their own nuances to their process. And mm-hmm. we don't want to take that away. I think a lot of the details in that really help dictate the final product. It makes it, it's kind of like your signature when you're
right.
building it. And so I think the problem with Bootstrap or Foundation, where it is very opinionated in those ways, you have that Bootstrap signature all over it. You can almost tell when a site's been built with Bootstrap fairly easily, even if it has been manipulated a lot. And so I just wanted to not have a louder than 10 mm-hmm. signature on it. Just make it very generic and loose for everybody.
Yeah, I think that's the best thing about it. And it was really the first time I encountered anything framework-like that I didn't feel
was telling you what to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's always my biggest challenge as a developer because I'm so opinionated. So I don't want someone else telling me what to do. You know, I want to come to my own decisions and I want to understand the reasons why I got to a decision, not just take a framework and implement it and say, "Oh, it does that." you know, not knowing why it does that or, you know, what in the cascade is leading to that. I want to be aware of what's going on. And this was the first time I really felt like I could make it my own. So I think that's one of the strongest benefits of LiveWire. I mean, other than giving your client a web-based experience earlier on in the process, but what do you think might be the challenges of using LiveWires, Travis?
I think the biggest challenge, and this is one I still haven't figured out, is that a lot of people, because it is so loose and unopinionated, people don't get it right away. Like, sure. It's really hard to explain how to use it and right. what to use it for. You guys have got it down pat, and that makes me ridiculously happy.
I'm glad.
And there are other people that, once they use it, they tend to really like it. They make it their own. And there's been people that have applied Angular onto it or done whatever with it. And that's great. But I think that's the biggest challenge for me, is showing how to use it. And then when they get into it, I think there's some pieces like, quote, grid framework in there, which is all it is a set of variables that are just percentages. Mm-hmm. And that's the only basic, with a couple other little pieces in there. But it's a very simple grid that, for myself, that's all I use most of the time. But I think it's too simple a lot of times, and it doesn't have a lot of structure to it. There's no classes that define it. It's just like a few things to help you make your own grid, I guess. And I think that people get hung up on that a little bit and don't really know how to use it. So I got to basically improve the documentation.
You know, though, I think that's a fair point, but I would respond based on my own experience that, especially when I started getting into trying to do responsive, the grid really threw me off because it changes. And, you know, writing the CSS to make it happen and having things fall nicely and retain the grid even as it shifts sizes or, you know, the number of elements per row or whatever. The fact that it wasn't too specific forced me to have to learn how to do it right myself.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I think that's one of those things that even, you know, I've been doing this for, I don't even know the math anymore. It's almost 20 years. And I still don't have everything perfect. And it,
sure.
You almost need to be, for me, I need to be put in a situation where I need to solve a problem. And, you know, I saw the grid in LiveWires and it didn't connect with me and I didn't quite get it. So it forced me to come up with my own solution. And now I have a grid that I'm comfortable working with and I feel is reflective of my process and how we build sites. And I probably, you know, it's one of those things where if you're given something like Bootstrap, you may never answer that question. How is this grid actually happening? You know what I mean? How is this actually falling here? And those things may seem simple if you just, you know, look at the code. But if you're not even looking at the code and just throwing some classes that a framework tells you to put on, then you don't know.
Yeah, that's totally true.
I do feel like it's a bit of a mindset shift that reminds me a little bit of our CMS world, too. Like, if you're used to working on WordPress sites, you kind of start off with someone's template and their prescriptive behavior. And the moment you start moving towards something like Craft or Expression Engine or Statamic, those kind of things where you create your own templates first, there is that weird uncomfortableness. You're like, what? Mm-hmm. I have to decide now? And you notice that, especially with inherited sites. You're like, oh, this person used to be a WordPress developer. You know, like, you can just tell because they're trying to fit something that was prescriptive before instead of starting from scratch and using and applying their own knowledge onto this system. And I feel like in some ways that's kind of like LiveWires, where you kind of have to have that shift where, okay, it's not Bootstrap or Foundation where it tells you that, you know, X-3 is three columns or something like that. Like, you kind of have to figure out how you want to work this thing and how you want to style it yourself from scratch.
And the best part, if I can just add on,
sure.
Is that yourself from scratch that you then use over and over
yes.
and over again and evolve over time so that
right.
it's not like you do it from scratch each time.
Yeah, and you're not set on the schedules of another developer. Like, you're not mm-hmm. waiting for the latest update for Bootstrap or Foundation, or if you do customize those other things, that there's a conflict with what you customize if you download. You know, it just
yeah.
becomes this like giant mess of like, what was my code and what was their code, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's funny. You hit on something else. I think a lot of people will try to, they think of it as oh, what happens when LiveWires has an update, and do I have to override stuff? And the thing I try to get people to do when they use it is don't override anything.
Right.
Just go in there and gut it and make it your own and make it your, yeah, use your own grid system that you've developed and add your own nuances and your own patterns and make your own framework out of it that you can use from client to client to client. And it'll evolve on its own, like ours does. Like, I rarely apply anything to LiveWires just because it's, I think other people would use it or anything
right.
like that. I do it because we're working on our own project and there's something that I keep running into and I'm like, oh, I got to throw this in the framework because this is super useful for
mm-hmm.
us.
Right.
And so there is a bit of, I guess, louder than 10 stink on some of it.
Sure,
But yeah, I think you hit it on the head, though, like with the grid system stuff. Making your own, even if you're used to another grid framework like Suzy or something like that, it's really easy to just put it on there instead. And yeah, I think it's great to just build your own team's tool set that, I don't know, it's kind of like your brand in some ways, and it goes right down to the code. It's not just a visual thing.
Yeah, I know I said it at the beginning, but I feel like LiveWires was sort of the impetus for us to go down that path for ourselves. And that we're still going down. Our framework, for lack of our internal framework, we call it starter files. And it's in constant evolution. It's, you know, now that I've seen the updates you've released to LiveWires, I'm going to go through it and see what I can bring in. And I feel like it's the way for Leia and I to share not only a common system that both of us can work in, her as the designer, me as the developer, but both of us together as the experts helping the client. She knows what I'm doing. She knows the patterns
right.
that I use. And so if she knows that she wants to show something to the client, she can just take my pattern. She knows what it is because we've created a framework and there's a module for her to drop in some buttons somewhere. And
right.
it makes things, you know, more efficient and more collaborative, and it feels less like I'm starting a new project by copying the last project and more like I'm starting a new project with a proven set of assets.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Oh, you guys, you're making my day. This is music to my ears to see that's why we made it. It's so
right.
you can make it your own and oh, that's amazing.
So let's talk a little bit about that efficiency. I mean, Emily and I have our own story regarding that. How, like, have you measured how much better communication is or how much faster processes have gone? Is it faster for your team?
It is definitely, I would say it's faster for certain parts of it. It changes the timeline. I guess it changes the proportions of what you're doing. So up front, obviously, there's a little more code involved, but then it saves a whole lot of code later on. The only thing I don't know any hard numbers because every project is so different, I think. But what I do know anecdotally is, like, we don't use it on everything. We usually use at least one component for it on every project, but coming back and forth to other things. Like right now, I'm working with a great client. It's on a product, and I'm actually wireframing using Sketch and Envision because we just decided early on that, look, I just don't want to, I'm not going to be coding any of this. I'm not going to be in the HTML or CSS. I don't even want to impose LiveWires markup in there. And it's using like a JavaScript front end. It's using Angular or something like that. And so I don't know how much, I don't know anything about Angular, and I don't know how much LiveWires is going to screw that up. And so we just decided really early that I'm just going to wireframe using an image editor and some, and Envision, but use kind of the same principles. Keep it really loose, keep it, you know, we're only doing it in mobile. Just everyone on the project understands the process of it. But then at the same time, we are using the style guide part of LiveWires to define, I use it just to figure out see the typography in a browser, make sure the fonts look good and test out the on a device, that kind of stuff. And so that's really helpful for me as a design tool. And we're documenting the design at the same time. So it gives the developer some stuff to work with. He can pull in my CSS where he needs it, I can adjust it and so on. And so I guess that experience, truthfully, working in an image editor and wireframes makes me miss LiveWires for doing that. But it's still, on my end, it definitely speeds things up. Like, I don't know, I found it was really weird going back to that, because on one hand, it was really quick to draw things out, but then I started noticing the weaknesses of image-based wireframes and prototypes when I had to change things, especially like, and especially if I did have to do a desktop wireframe for whatever reason, I'd have to duplicate that work on the mobile version. And then I'd have to, if text updated, I'd have to change it on these states. And if, especially if it's more interactive, you have to, there's just so much more work. Whereas if in HTML, you know, you just change a couple lines of CSS and then it fixes it globally. So I definitely notice for iterative stuff, for revisions, I find personally CSS and HTML kind of quicker. I don't know. It's easier for me, but I understand it's not that easy for all designers, but for me, it's definitely the way to go.
Yeah, I think, like you've said a couple times, every project's going to have its own requirements. What's going to work best for that project? And, you know, you have to be flexible if you're going to be successful with your client. But I also feel like that LiveWires has improved our efficiency, if only because we now use the LiveWires become the foundation of the production code. So we're saving time there. And I feel like it gets us talking to the client about interaction a little sooner than we ever had before. And so we work out those things sooner. It always felt like that stuff showed up at the end. You know, oh, I don't like what happens when I do this on the browser. And, you know, we're 2 weeks out from launch. So we're getting, you know, input on this stuff sooner rather than later. So I feel like it helps with that. I can't say it like saves a ton of time. You know, it really depends on how adept. I'm not adept at old school wireframing. Like I'm not fast with OmniGraffle or Cuckoo or whatever you might use. I'm not fast with those, but I am fast in code. So I think it comes down to who's creating it. But Leigh and I always start with hand sketches regardless of what we do.
Right. But I'm not like precious about it either, though. You know, like I don't have like fancy grid notebook with perfect, you know, units and everything like that. It's always 100% loose just to get the ideas out of my brain. And then essentially, like, after that's cleaned up, like, it's sketch for us, cleaned up just so that the other person can interpret the chicken scratch. And then once that interpretation is just solid, then we get into LiveWires. Because at that point, then you can start playing around with, you know, making things more precise. To me personally, like, I don't understand people being precious about their sketches or wireframes. I guess maybe if they're really trying to show that to their client, like the fixed stuff as the deliverable. But it wastes so much time, because by the time you're in the browser, you notice all these micro, you know, interactions and behaviors that are even irrelevant that you didn't catch in, you know, the traditional wireframe situation, which is what I love about working in something like LiveWires, because, you know, the like proportions and even how things flow is so, so different once you actually get it into the browser than no matter how pixel perfect you're trying to get your static comp. There's always going to be something where it's just like, oh, this one little like orphan word is like ruining the layout, you know? And you don't get that until you actually put things into a browser context.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, the other thing that you brought up is forgetting all the little pieces. I find getting it in the browser, even having the big style guide, that's how the style guide actually started too, was you always forget things as a designer, like error states or like a sign out process or forget password, like all these little templates that add up that you just, it's so easy to skip over when you're not actually able to use it. And so for us, it's like almost like a checklist. You're forced to go through the motions and pretend it's so much easier to pretend you're an actual visitor using the product, and you can just trip up all you want. And I find you catch so many more things than at the end, especially if you're working with another developer and they're like, do you have error state styles for your forms or anything like that? And you realize, oh no, can you just squeeze this little error under the field here? And so, Yeah, that's a big thing.
Yeah, and I just want to add too, in terms of even sending stuff for client deliverables, sending them something that's already in the context of their final product, like in the browser, helps them understand your choices so much better, because clients will do things that you never would even think about when you give them something. So for example, in a regular traditional wireframe, we'd normally send them something like a PDF. But the thing about PDFs is that you can zoom in, zoom out, you know, all those kind of things.
Yeah.
And we have these useless conversations that waste so much time, basically saying, are you seeing it at 100%? No, no, the typeface is not going to be that large, you know? And then this is even if it was gray box, it's just like they just focus on like, wow, this website looks huge, or wow, this website looks so small, I can't read anything. I'm like, well, because you're looking at it at 50%, you know? You're looking at the PDF at 50% because your browser is like shrunken and it just automatically was 50%. And then so you just have these like huge conversations of just trying to get them to look at it in actual size. But if it's in the browser, that's the actual size, you know, unless they've messed with the zooms of their browser, which 99% of clients have not, because they're not web developers like us. They're actually seeing what the proportions of content is.
Well, I mean, even then, even if you do, and you have the ability to intentionally zoom in and out, and it behaves exactly how it should.
Right.
Right.
You kind of have those ideas. So,
right.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I never even thought about that with the PDF zooming in and out.
Oh my God.
So
it just happened a couple weeks ago.
Exactly. It's like, can you zoom in? Can you give me a screenshot of what you're looking at? And then you see it's like, oh, they're looking at it at 50%, you know? No wonder they think it's like the smallest website in the world.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Clients surprise you.
Yeah. So Travis, do you use any other quote unquote frameworks in your design and development processes? And when I say frameworks, I'm using it in the most broad term, more like some assets from some other provider, I guess. Like, for example, this isn't a framework, but we use it in all of our systems these days, is we use Font Awesome for our icon fonts.
Mm-hmm.
And Leia designs around that. I develop with that. And that's part of all of our things moving forward. It's not a framework, but it's like an asset. Do you use anything like that regularly?
Yes and no. I have a few fallbacks. Livewires, I include Font Awesome by default these days, just so you because it's a huge library and it's easy. I don't always use those in a final product. Once I get into design, I'll sometimes search for other icon sets, things like that. But that usually changes quite a bit. There's a few JavaScript, like jQuery things that I use if I need to and things like that. Most of the framework is, I don't have a huge need to use other frameworks a lot of the time, unless it's, it depends. That's really on the front end and in design, that part. On the back end of stuff, like these days, I always use Craft when I can. It's awesome. But also occasionally have some older client sites using Expression Engine, things like that. So CMSs, I guess, that I use. There's some great tools for deployment that I use. One's called Surge, surge.sh. And our office mates here build it. And it's just an amazing little instant CDN that you can just, through the command line, you enter two commands and basically you've deployed your site to just a temporary host if you want. Or you can make it permanent. You can throw a domain on it. But it's amazing. They let you do the basic stuff for free and it's fast. I use that for a lot of things recently. They just launched it. Other than that, I don't know. I'm pretty open. I'm not really a fundamentalist when it comes to my frameworks other than maybe Livewires itself, but I like trying different things out for sure, and we'll play around.
How about your top IA resources? Like, do you have any specific wireframing resources besides obviously Livewires, but are there articles or websites where you think, or tools where you think it's going to improve your process?
There's nothing that I don't keep up on a lot of that end of stuff these days. I find that we've got such a dialed in process for ourselves that we sort of came to it from a bunch of things before it, but we really focus on just content, writing content, getting that into our things really quickly. And we do, I think one of the big things that we try to do is not test our own designs. We test them or have them tested, but we try not to be, I try not to be the one that tests them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It's just puts a different layer in between. Like, I just don't trust my own confirmation bias my work. And so sometimes, you know, ideally we'd like work with someone who's specifically like a UX researcher in an ideal sense, or someone who's got some research experience and scientific literacy that I don't have, where they can put together user tests, things like that. Because I have no illusions that what I'm designing could be totally wrong. And so we just like to not... yeah, try to separate that from the actual design process a little bit. So,
are you able to do that with every project? Or is that really something that there's got to be a budget for it?
It depends. Typically, we find the need for that is directly proportional to the budget. Anyway, like if it's a small marketing site, we're not going to worry too much about it. We will test it with the client and a few, like maybe get a couple people to look at it, and we might make some changes that way. The bigger it is, like if it's a full app or something like that, then usually we'll have a budget. We can work with that, and we try and build that into it and make it a part of the process for sure. So yeah, it kind of naturally works out, I guess.
Yeah. So if that particular point about having someone else test your work, it's one of the things you listed in this. Would you call like a manifesto that you wrote about... like it's, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I don't know if that word has a negative connotation. It doesn't to me, but it's kind of like it's aspirational, and it's, you know, here's what might be wrong and here's where we could do better. And that was one of the things you talked about, is having someone else test your systems. But can you talk a little bit about why you felt you wanted to write about how everything's starting to look the same and we're kind of designing like machines?
Especially since you wrote a framework.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's really weird. Like, I don't consider it a manifesto at all. It actually started as a talk for a local typography meetup. And it's been kind of boiling in my head, and it's been in there ever since I started building Livewires, really. So one of the reasons I built Livewires is because of those other frameworks lock you into that box. And I wanted to design something that allowed much more variation. And so I think with the Design Machines article, the big point, and this is probably something I should have made more clear in it, is that I think designing systems is fine and using a system is great. Like, that's, print design has always relied on systems to bring it up to kind of that minimum standard, right? We still have general templates for types of content, or we have, you know, there's always going to be a table of contents, there's running heads, there's meta information on all the pages, and every magazine is different, but they all kind of have these standards. And so, and you have a grid system, right? All of these systems come into play. But I think on the web, because of our approaches to frameworks and CMSs, like especially like you mentioned WordPress, that's almost built into WordPress. I don't know how you build outside of it without a few good plugins, is that you kind of have to build a templated system, and there's not really much room for variation beyond that. And so I think because of this approach, we've sort of hit a lot of sameness on the web. We reuse a lot of the same patterns, things like that. And it's not that the patterns themselves are bad. It's just that they get overused, right? They're used in a lot of the same templates. They're used in a lot of the same frameworks. And so I think the call is to kind of look at those and start building systems that allow you to build on top of it, build variation into the process. And we understand that you can't necessarily do that with every project, but you can build in little pieces on every project usually. But I mean, that's why we use things like Craft, because it allows us at the CMS there. So it allows us to, right now we have basically one template that runs the entire site and like two fields. But because those fields are so powerful, we can design crazy pages with art direction and we can go nuts on it. And I don't even think we've come close to hitting the full potential of what we can do in that. But for us, it's a lot of freedom without a lot of work. And I think there's a lot of potential out there that just we aren't quite reaching with the current tools and approaches. So
yeah, I felt while I was reading this that sweet spot you just described, like a tremendous amount of flexibility to be creative and get an experience out there, but also having the system in place that lets you do it efficiently. So you still, you know, are profitable as a business and your clients happy. And, you know, I was just reading this and your last question is like, how are you going to be different from the machines? And I was like, I don't know, you know, because I feel like I'm not at that sweet spot yet. I feel like we could push ourselves further, but right now we're sort of focused on building that internal system that will let us push ourselves forward once the system's sort of stable.
Mm-hmm. I think for like some good starting points, and this is something I didn't really get into, but I think it might be worth another article or whatever, but it's how to start bringing in things in small steps, right? It's not like going crazy and building really rich interfaces that require a designer to be on every single blog post or every single page. You can start small with, like, Craft has it. For instance, Craft has its wonderful matrix field. So yeah, maybe it's setting up your content blocks. And so instead of just having one giant field for content, you can have like, here's an opportunity as a client where you can put a pre-sized image on the left and a piece of text that runs beside it. And then in the next section, maybe it's just a straight column of text. And, you know, adding some opportunities for very controlled variations can go a long way. Even things as simple, if you're going to have like a, maybe you have a big banner up top on the top of the page, maybe just giving the client an option of four brand colors to change between or to switch between the two typefaces that you've allowed them to in the top, just to give it a little bit different flavor, get them thinking of how the content can speak just a little bit differently from everything else on the page while keeping within some really strict guidelines. So those are some things we try to think about, especially for client sites. We don't want to give them the full control of everything let them go haywire. But we like to just introduce little bits and pieces here and there. And I think that can go a long ways for just a relatively little amount of work and low risk for them screwing things up.
And I mean, I personally, as a designer, I have hope because the web, we tend to forget because we work on it every day. It's still super, super, super young. Print has had centuries to play around with grid systems and layouts and the constraints regarding that. So people have had time to figure out how to push the boundaries and establish things like that. And I just feel like right now in the design phase that our industry is in, we're just trying to like raise it to a minimum level. Because remember, less than 5 years ago, we only had to design with Georgia, Times New Roman, Arial, and Verdana. That was less than 5 years ago. And it's only been recently that we're even allowed to play with more than that. So, you know, it's just like a matter of, I feel like the sameness with frameworks and with design, all those kind of things, is just getting to that point where people are just comfortable with what we have. So there's like a minimum standard, and then eventually people are going to be pushing for more, because at some point, just like with any business, if you're all the same, then why would someone choose your site, your design, your service, your product, if it looks exactly like the other one?
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you. I think that we are just at a point where, you know, we're getting used to all these crazy things. People are still figuring out how to work with devices properly and how to even things on the process level, how to present things to clients and how to work with each other. Like the other part of our business, the project management side, we work with this every day, right? We work with agencies all the time that have no idea how to approach this stuff. And the only way you can learn, because there's so few resources, is to sort of do what's working for somebody else a lot of times. And so a big part of that side of our business too is helping them build processes that can, you know, let them be more flexible to sort of carve their own path and differentiate a little bit in those ways too, and how to do that efficiently. And so, yeah, it's a big challenge. But I think you're right. I'm pretty optimistic about it. I think we'll be forced to improve, as always, as we always have trundled along and gotten better over the years. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I on some days it feels like a double-edged sword. I love the aspect about the career I'm in where I'm always learning, but there are some days where I'm like, oh God, I would just like everything to be the same for a period of months that I can just have some knowns to work with.
Oh my God. I feel that some ways. I feel that with front-end development these days, I can't keep up.
Like, yeah,
I used
me
to be
either.
Really on top of it, but things like you have, especially with JavaScript frameworks and things like that, mm-hmm. you have like React and Ember and all these things that are just tearing up the mix, and they're even influencing how CSS is written and HTML is written. And so it's crazy. I'm getting to the point where either I need to keep following that or else kind of just accept that I know my vanilla stuff and just keep on that for the design part. And yeah, I can't be as versatile as I once was, maybe.
Yeah, there's just almost too much to keep up with.
Oh, it's...
I mean, and that's how exactly works.
Like, I hate frameworks, but wouldn't it be nice if I could just count on one thing?
Yeah.
Right, totally. Oh my gosh, Travis, this was a fantastic conversation, but we are running out of time. So before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better.
Okay.
You ready?
Let's do this. Yeah.
Okay. Question one. Android or iOS?
iOS.
If you were stranded on a desert island and can only bring three things, what would you bring?
My glasses, my iPad, and my wife. Reverse the order of that, though. Rachel comes first.
You saved the best for last.
Yes.
What's your favorite TV show?
Right now, Mr. Robot.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite dessert?
Espresso ice cream.
Mm-hmm. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Ooh, that's really hard. I really like what we do. drummer in a band.
All right. What profession would you not like to try?
Oh, this is a hard one. Everything. Sears Portrait Studio photographer. Oh. I actually was that once, and I never want to do that again.
What's the latest article or blog post you read?
Oh, it's called Apprenticeships. Do We Need Them in Design? That's not the exact title, but it's about apprenticeships. I should know what it's called because we just posted it in our magazine last night, which you can find at louderthan10.com/cokes.
Good plug. So if you could have a superpower, what would it be?
I could fly.
What music do you like to work to?
Really angry music and fast music. So a lot of punk and indie and metal and things like that.
All right, last question. Cats or dogs?
Cats.
Nice.
Definitely cats.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us, Travis.
Thank you.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
On Twitter at Travis Gertz and on our website, louderthan10.com.
Awesome. Thanks again, Travis.
Thank you.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Thank you, Kraft.
We'd also like to thank our partners, Arcus Tech, DevOT, and EE Insider.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you liked this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we will talk about designer-developer collaboration and workflows with Megan Zlock and Owen Shiflett. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, controlclickcast.com/schedule, for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.